Good morning. My name is Jim Bain. I represent the appellants in this case. As the court knows, there's a number of issues because both sides appeal different aspects of the trial court's order. Our appeal focuses on the trial court ruling that the two limited partnerships, PCSR and JJWM, which paid nothing into the court registry for the supersedious bond, now somehow owns the $2.5 million bond that others paid. Creditors or plaintiffs also seek a different review standard, saying that the court made findings on this, but as our papers indicated, the court adopted verbatim the plaintiff's proposed judgment, including even a error in the reference to a rule. It referenced the wrong rule, so it doesn't indicate a great deal of analysis went into that. Further, the record confirms who deposited the money. I don't think there's any issue about that. Frankly, we don't see any valid basis for this ruling. It seems to have no legal basis, no factual basis, no support in the record, and I'd prefer to defer addressing it unless the court has questions. I think our papers address it adequately.
Okay, I have some questions.
Okay.
The judge said that the Court of Appeals affirmed the successor liability judgment. Do you disagree with that?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals, yes, confirmed the successor liability judgment, but confirmed it only as to the specified remedies that the trial court selected.
The Court of Appeals has several statements in there. We don't make findings. Several statements in there about the liability of JJWM, which is really the crux of the issue here, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it said that, for example, it said lack of equity in the ranch is immaterial to JJWM's liability for the debts of PCSR. So it affirmed, did it not, the liability of JJWM for the debts of PCSR. That's the language of the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals did make statements along that line, Your Honor, but the judgment that was being reviewed nowhere stated that the court was awarding plaintiffs or ordering JJWM to pay as a successor.
Right, and the Court of Appeals went on to say, once the jury determined JJWM to be the successor, awarding money damages was unnecessary because JJWM became liable for all debt of PCSR. You don't disagree the Court of Appeals said that.
No, clearly the court said that, Your Honor.
And
there's no question about that.
Are the words hard to understand? Are they ambiguous?
No, I don't believe they are. I believe they're dicta, and I believe they're not supported by the case that they cite, the Ed Peters case.
Well, you say that they're dicta, but aren't they the law of the case now that the Court of Appeals has reviewed this?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that it's dicta because there was no successor liability to be addressed because there wasn't in the order. There wasn't in the court's judgment.
Well, the verdict of the jury was although it was an equitable claim tried to the jury nonetheless rendered a verdict.
The jury rendered actually two verdicts. They said, yes, we find in favor of the plaintiffs on successor liability, but there is no damages, zero damages for successor liability. And in reaching the zero damages ruling, the jury refused to comply with instruction 32, which directed them to find damages for successor liability.
Was there an instruction that said you can only award damages once for one claim, one of those instructions?
No.
The Colorado Court of Appeals in that division opinion also said the conclusion does not preclude these plaintiffs from refiling their liens or otherwise enforcing cost judgments against JJWM as successor to PCSR. Of course, the Court of Appeals said that too.
Yes,
that's exactly what the plaintiffs did here, did they not?
That was in footnote number 12, and I would contend that that again is dicta. Not only is it dicta, it's extraneous comment that deals with the future. No one had filed such liens, so the court wasn't resolving any issue before the court at that time.
Well, there had been liens judgment liens against the ranch, but those liens were, well, reinstated by the trial court. They were extinguished by the foreclosure, reinstated by the trial court, as I understand it, and then the Court of Appeals reversed the reinsertion of the liens.
That's correct.
Reasons I won't try to restate at this point.
Yes, the...
So there had been liens.
There had been judicial...
And that's why the Court of Appeals said refiling their liens or otherwise enforcing cost judgment. They didn't say file, they said refiling.
Yes, there were liens. The liens were extinguished by the foreclosure because the trial court ruled that the foreclosure was a fraudulent transfer. The Court of Appeals reversed that ruling and stated that it was a valid foreclosure. So all of those judgment liens were gone, except for Thornton, which was an omitted party and had the right to redeem.
I understand. And then the Court of Appeals said they could refile those liens, otherwise enforcing the cost judgment against JJWM as successor to PCSR. And your position is that all of that is dicta.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we disagree with you that it's not dicta, then we can address whether the plaintiffs properly filed their judgments against JJWM. So let me turn to that for a moment, okay? The trial court also found that the supersedious bond was posted on behalf of all defendants. You don't disagree with that, do you?
Do I disagree that the trial court said that?
No, that it was in fact posted. That question always comes out that way, doesn't it? You don't disagree that the bond was posted on behalf of all defendants, do you? Or do you?
Well, three defendants provided the money to the bank, which provided the cashier's check. Yes, the bond covered all the defendants. All the defendants were jointly and severally liable for the money judgment on conspiracy. The only other defendant that was liable under the initial judgment was JJWM under the successor liability judgment.
Is it your position that it didn't bond that claim as well?
It could well have bonded that claim. I don't think anyone considered it, but
Didn't you take a position in filings to the district court that bond was to bond all defendants on all eight claims? Your filing said that, right?
Yes. That's
and the judge relied on that in making this decision that you say has erroneous conclusions in it.
I don't know that the judge relied on that. That's what it said, but that he took from the plaintiff's proposed judgment, including the erroneous rule reference.
Well, you say the plaintiffs wrote this order. I doubt they wrote all of it because it didn't release the money to them.
They did not write it.
He must have rewritten some of it.
That's true.
Let me explore with you, because we have very limited time. I'm having a very difficult time understanding how the mechanics of this bond. It's a rather unusual situation.
Indeed.
I see in the record a picture, a copy of a cashier's check for $2.4 million, okay? That's what your clients put up as the bond, correct?
Yes.
Now, normally a supersedious bond has on it the conditions of release and how it's going to be paid back and all those things, but there's nothing like that on this cashier's check.
You're correct, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. And in fact, even a cashier's check usually has on it at least the name of the remitter, and it's blurry on the copy, but it looks like it says N/A, not applicable. There is no remitter disclosed on this cashier's check, is there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the court ruled that there was 10 days. The court denied our letter of credit and property bond,
right,
and gave 10 days to supply $2.5 million.
Okay.
And that's how it worked out.
Okay.
Because it
Bank of the West issued the cashier's check. It's payable to the clerk of the court of Park County, correct?
Yes, okay. Correct.
The cashier's check issued by Bank of the West must have been secured by something. I'm assuming Bank of the West didn't just write a cashier's check for nothing.
Yes, that's
true. Is it secured by a certificate of deposit?
No, it was secured by money in the three individuals' account, which we included that in the affidavit and in the banking statements.
Why is there a certificate of deposit attached to one of your filings? If there is a certificate of deposit issued by Bank of the West, it's exactly the same amount as the bond, maybe a couple thousand off, actually.
I think the bottom line is that was a mistake. And that was my mistake. I filed that. I understood that a certificate of deposit had been filed. It had not been. In fact, it was a cashier's check, but I wasn't.
But there is a certificate of deposit in the record for the same amount of money issued by Bank of the West in the name of JJWM. And you submitted that to the court as one of the indications.
Yes.
I thought it's security for the cashiers?
Yes, I did. That was my mistake.
And you're saying that that certificate does not secure the cashier's check?
It does not.
Okay.
It was completely my mistake.
Okay. The cashier's check was delivered to the clerk of the Park County Court. What did, I think it's a woman, so what did she do with this cashier's check? Is she holding it or did she cash it and put the money in an interest-bearing account?
I don't know, Your Honor.
You don't know if the money's in an interest-bearing account? You haven't followed up? Okay. Is the cashier's check or the money that was in an interest-bearing account still in the hands of Park County?
Yes.
Or has it been transferred to the water court?
No, it's in the hands of Park County.
Okay. Have you filed objections to the garnishments in the water court?
We have.
Okay. Those have not been ruled upon because the water court decided to stay the case pending this proceeding?
Exactly.
Okay. I think you've answered most of, if not all of my questions I have for now. So if you have more to say, that's fine. If not, whatever.
I think I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
If I could.
All right, Mr. Bain, you have about 4 minutes and 10 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court? Counsel, Mr. Bain. As a cross-appellant, I'm not sure if I get an opportunity for rebuttal. I don't think I've ever had this scenario before. I asked your clerk, and she wasn't sure either, so I thought I'd ask you. If I am entitled to rebuttal as a cross-appellant, I would love to reserve a few.
You're entitled to sir rebuttal, yes.
Sir rebuttal.
All That's right. correct. As to the cross-appeal.
Okay.
Right.
Let's see if I can keep those issues straight.
Okay, and you're Mr. Rogers, is that correct?
Bill Rogers, yes, on behalf of the plaintiffs, all of them. In this appeal.
Mr. Rogers, tell me, would you please, why isn't the comment by the Court of Appeals regarding JJWM's liability for debts of PCSR and the footnote that Mr. Bain referenced an advisory opinion?
Well, Mr. Bain, in the pleadings and before you today, referred to that as dicta. But in fact, the Court of Appeals makes that observation not just in footnote 12, but in a couple of other places.
Well, if it's an advisory opinion, isn't it also dicta?
I don't believe it's either one. It's part of the basis for one of the conclusions that the Court of Appeals reached on one of the arguments, I believe it had to do with the successor liability claim itself, that there were no damages awarded. The Court of Appeals rejected that argument, and it did so for two separate and distinct reasons, which it enunciated. It said that damages were unnecessary because of the very equitable nature of successor liability, and it said as the second reason, because JJWM became, in essence, PCSR and liable for all of its debts. It wasn't dicta, and it wasn't advisory. It was one of the two bases for the ruling that the Court of Appeals issued on that specific issue. This case has been around for a long time. It was initiated 17 years ago. The plaintiffs herein opposed the water court proceeding that PCSR commenced. 11 years ago, the water court determined that it was frivolous and groundless and awarded costs. Those costs were liquidated 10 years ago with a judgment for just over $1.1 million. 8 years ago, JJWM was formed as an admitted artifice or plan to avoid paying those original debts. 6 years ago, this lawsuit was initiated. 4 years ago, it was tried up in Park County. 2 years ago, this court issued its opinion, which I have referred to as PCSR 1, which perhaps isn't very elegant, but that is the decision that was issued 2 years ago. And now, here we are, and it is time for PCSR / JJWM to satisfy its lawful debts. There are two issues before you, the first of which is the scope of that supersedious bond. Having appealed the successor liability verdict and judgment, having sought a stay, and having posted a bond to enable that appeal, the issue is that bond available to the plaintiffs who succeeded in having successor liability affirmed by this court? That's the first issue. The second one is only one necessarily reached if, despite the crystal clear pleadings that accompanied the posting of that bond, you determine that the supersedious bond is not available. Then you must determine if those funds that were posted up in Park County are available to be garnished by the plaintiffs.
Can you tell us whether the funds are still in Park County or the water court?
I can tell you what I surmise and believe, but I wish I could say with greater certainty. It is my understanding, because I think I would know if those funds had ever left Park County. Mm-hmm. I understand they were deposited in an account Whether or not that account bears interest, I have no idea. I know that the water court did not go and take those funds because it was awaiting determinations. There were interveners, there were pleadings, there was motions practice in the water court, which I think always reasonably stayed pending the outcome of this appeal as perhaps being unnecessary.
But you wouldn't object to transferring the funds to the water court?
Well, I guess I would, only in the sense that I think it's unnecessary, because I think it formed the bond that should be released to the plaintiffs. We only need to get to the water court if this court determines that the bond did not cover and stay the successor liability appeal. Because if it did, then the district court on remand would be instructed to release those bond funds to the plaintiff to satisfy the judgment against JJWM. So I don't think we need to get to the water court. And that's one of the reasons why the water court stayed.
But Mr. Bain said, and confirmed, I think, that there are objections that his clients have filed to the garnishment. And we are in no position to resolve those objections. They're for the water. They are for the water. They were filed in the water court. Aren't they for the water court to resolve?
Well, without straying too far into the water court proceedings, because quite frankly, there were a number of pleadings filed there, and I did not review them before I came over here. But the essence of the complaint in the water court, and the objections, rather, in the water court, were the same as the ones being presented to this court. They claim they funded it, not the entity, and they claim that JJWM is not the same as PCSR and not subject to water court jurisdiction. I mean, these issues really overlap with what you're being asked
right.
to decide.
Be that as it may, you issued garnishments under the water court's jurisdiction, and the clerk of the court, it happens to be a clerk of the court here, but it could have been a bank, right? And
correct.
If a bank had answered a garnishment saying, yes, we have money belonging to a depositor, and then the depositor filed an objection, that would have to be sorted out by the court that issued the garnishments.
That's correct.
Not by Park County. It just happens to be that the holder of the money is the clerk of the court.
Yes.
So therefore, I think it isn't inappropriate to refer this matter to the water court, is it?
Only if you determine issue one unfavorably to the plaintiffs. Because if you determine that the bond that was posted by JJWM and the other defendants so that they could pursue their successor liability appeal is not nevertheless available to the plaintiffs, do you even get to that issue of garnishment?
Okay.
If that makes sense. The complaint in this case, and I'm not so sure that there's much of an issue here, but the complaint in this case, as originally filed 6 years ago, alleged that JJWM, and I'm reading, is a successor entity to PCSR and liable to plaintiffs for all debts and judgments owed to plaintiffs by PCSR. The judge and the jury agreed, and the defendants appealed all orders against all entities or parties and all judgments. They took every aspect of the Park County trial and judgment up on appeal. This court then affirmed the unsuccessful challenge to successor liability. The verdict and affirmance established a new monetary liability of JJWM, which didn't exist before we filed our lawsuit and went to trial up in Park County. That's what was appealed by the plaintiffs mm-hmm. in this case.
So a judgment was issued against JJWM on that verdict?
Inherently, when the judge reinstated those liens by themselves don't exist without some sort of judgment. It's merely a mechanism of collection. Mm-hmm. It's not a judgment in and of itself.
So the order denying the judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, and entering judgment was tantamount to a judgment against JJWM, in your view?
Not just in my view. I mean, if one reviews the pleadings filed by JJWM and the other defendants in PCSR 1, it was assumed, and the pleadings I think are relatively clear, that was the case. I mean, no one has ever contended, quite frankly, until this reply brief, that wasn't the case. And I don't think it's an issue, to the extent it's a preservable issue, it wasn't one that was preserved by these defendants. No one has ever claimed that notwithstanding the liens that were reinstated, the jury's verdict, the judge's verdict, the judge's judgment, that JJWM wasn't liable for the debts of PCSR. That's why the plaintiffs filed this lawsuit in the first place. That was the result they successfully achieved. And the language that you already quoted, I actually have in my notes to quote to you, and I'm not going to waste your time reading it back to you. In at least three, and you I'm sure you appreciate that, but in at least three distinct places, the Court of Appeals couldn't have been clearer about what was necessarily involved in a successor liability determination. We alleged and proved and successfully achieved a determination that the two entities were one and the same. They created the second entity to avoid their obligations through the first entity. That's what the jury and the judge determined in this case. And the amount of the liability that flows from that determination has never been disputed. It was a stipulated fact in the trial 4 years ago. $1.1 million had changed. That's never changed. What happened is they posted a bond. They posted a bond and they challenged that successor liability determination. They received a stay preventing any mechanism of collection efforts to pursue the successor liability judgment that we as plaintiffs obtained. Because of that stay, we could do no collection efforts. In fact, when there was an effort to collect against two parties that were not included in the appeal, they quickly filed pleadings both in this court and in the trial court saying, no, you can't do that. And in case there's any mistake, the protective order, which they drafted and submitted to Judge Barton, reads as follows. Plaintiffs are prohibited from utilizing any form of post-judgment proceeding in aid of execution against any Sportsman's Ranch defendant during the pendency of this appeal. This was issued by the trial court in May 2011, confirming what they had done at the very beginning, in the very outset, through their pleadings. They prevented any mechanism of collection with their stay and with their bond, and they lost. And the plaintiffs are now entitled to take advantage of that bond, having been foreclosed from any collection efforts during the intervening time frame. I think one of the things that makes that and their position here so untenable is that if all of their arguments on issue one, which is the scope of the supersedeas bond, if all of their arguments on issue one were to be, I don't want to say believed, accepted by this court, how would they then respond to the following? Thornton's lien was not voided by virtue of the foreclosure. The trial court and then this court affirmed that Thornton's lien still existed as to the property. That was part of what they considered to be the remedy, which I think is a misnomer as to what happened at the trial court level. That's still around. And so even under their construction of the supersedeas bond, what I would submit a tortured construction of the pleadings and the bond itself, Thornton would still be able to collect on its lien because it still has one from that bond, even under their argument.
So that does Thornton have a claim against part of the proceeds of the bond?
Thornton is a plaintiff along with all of the other plaintiffs, okay. And so it does. In oral argument in this case, over 2 years ago, Judge Webb asked me if we affirm successor liability. I went and reviewed it last night. This is how I know this. He asked me, will you be able to collect out of the bonds if we affirm successor liability? Absolutely. And he asked Mr. Bain the very same question. And his response was 2 years ago, well, I haven't studied that, but I think you're right, Your Honor. That was the answer 2 years ago. Whether that's estoppel, I don't know. It's frankly not something.
You haven't argued that in your brief.
I have not argued that, but it's what happened for this court.
All right.
There are a number of other arguments.
Let me pursue something then. Given what you say, the judge nonetheless found that this is the finding of Judge Barton in this case, the supersedeas bond is no longer necessary to secure the judgment and cannot be released directly to the plaintiffs.
That's why we're here.
Conclusion.
That's correct.
All right. And I, despite what Mr. Bates says, I'm pretty sure you didn't put those words in his order.
I don't think anyone put words in Judge Barton's mouth. I think he wrote his own orders.
What do you understand his reason is then for not allowing the bond money to be released to the plaintiff?
Well, I have no greater understanding than what's contained in the order itself, Your Honor. There's no way for me to know that, of course, other than that I believe he's wrong. Okay. It's unsupported by the record in this case, which I think is very clear.
Okay. Let me address this issue about who put up the money, if I can phrase it that way. Still unclear to me. There is the certificate of deposit in the which the defendants filed in connection with the posting the bond. Can you shed any light on what that certificate deposit is doing there?
Well, I think, despite protestations to the contrary, that the bond funders, as they call themselves, put up the money here and that should be accepted by this court, I think it is at best murky. There is JJWM written on one of the deposit notes, and I wasn't involved in doing that. At footnote 13 and page 37 of our brief, we sort of address some of the murkiness that exists here. I don't think it's relevant. I think it's immaterial who funded it, because that's not our position in the case. But I don't think it's established in any event. And I think what we look at instead, which doesn't have the murkiness, which is very clear, is the pleadings that accompany the posting of the bond. All defendants, all claims. The language could not have been clearer.
I think there's no question that all defendants got the benefit of the posting of the bond and that proceedings against all of them were stayed. I think the question is whether there's some kind of equitable rule or some authority to support the position that if one entity posts the bond on behalf of all the defendants, that entity doesn't get their that entity doesn't have any right to object to the distribution of the monies at the end of the case.
I think the right, to the extent one were to be found, recognized, or established, would be a right between the entities,
between
not one that affects us. I have a little over a minute left,
Okay.
And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to save it for rebuttal.
Yes. Sir rebuttal.
The time's yours, Mr. Rogers.
I think there's no question that the judge's initial order, the judgment, specified only money damages. The only money damages for conspiracy. The only remedy for successor liability was the lien reinstatement. Now, that was based on the plaintiff's proposed order and their response to the judgment NOV. They specifically stated there's only one legal remedy, and that's conspiracy, and that's where the jury found damages. They specifically said there's only equitable remedies for successor liability and fraudulent transfer. That's what they said. That's what they got. That's what the judge adopted. That's what the Court of Appeals said. The Court of Appeals said there's only one monetary remedy, and that is conspiracy. The Court of Appeals then said we're not going to address the prejudgment issue, the prejudgment interest issue, because there's no money judgment left. On remand, the judge interpreted his own order, his own judgment order, and said the only money judgment is on conspiracy. We only have equitable remedies on successor liability, so the bond has served its purpose.
Are you saying that the bond, you agree with the general proposition that a bond can secure an equitable judgment?
Sure.
Can secure against enforcement of that? You agree with that, right?
Sure.
Why can't the bond here be interpreted as supporting an equitable judgment?
I think it can, Your Honor. The bond would support the equitable remedy of lien reinstatement on the ranch if, for example, JJWM disposed of the ranch. The plaintiffs never filed transcripts of judgment or anything on the ranch, so presumably JJWM could have sold the ranch, taken the money, and said, see you later. In that instance, the bond would have covered the equitable judgment.
But as I understand it, when the case was remanded from the first iteration on appeal, both parties understood that successor liability could be collected out of the bond.
I think if you go back, Your Honor, we have consistently stated that the only remedy for successor liability is lien reinstatement. We have said that from the very beginning. I heard what counsel said. From the very beginning, we said the only remedy for successor liability is lien reinstatement and equitable remedy. If that is the only remedy, then no, they can't collect anything else. Does that answer your question?
Well, did you tell Judge Webb that you thought he was probably right, that the bond would cover successor liability?
Well, I think we did say, yes, that the bond covers successor liability, and I explained a moment ago how it would do that.
So how is any part of that opinion dicta?
The Court of Appeals decision?
Yes.
The Court of Appeals was talking about filing liens in the future. That pretty much has to be dictated in the footnote. It's not relevant because no one had filed the liens. The other portion of the decision where it talks about the jury found successor liability, so that verdict means you don't have to determine damages. I don't think that is the law. I think that is dicta. It was the second basis for the Court of Appeals decision. The first was that the jury awarded no damages. Actually, the Court of Appeals was addressing whether providing instruction 32, which directed the jury to award $1.2 million on successor liability, the Court of Appeals was addressing whether that was error. They said no, it wasn't error because one, the jury didn't award damages, and two, you don't need to award damages under the Ed Peters case. The Ed Peters case, if you read that decision, only dealt with whether a claim was equitable or not. It in no way held what the Court of Appeals cited it
for. All right. Thank you, Mr. Bank. Mr. Rogers, I want to give you an additional 30 seconds.
I hope I won't need it for my very first SIR rebuttal. I just want to make 2 points, I think. I have heard in the briefs and I have heard today that the only thing these plaintiffs could have done is pursued liens, having successfully sued these folks and gotten a successor liability verdict, which was affirmed. This is just plainly false. The defendants in this case are confusing judgments, which is a debt in a liquid sum that's owed, in this case, by an entity, with liens, which are nothing more than an enforcement mechanism, which allows foreclosure of real property. Plaintiffs didn't achieve in this lawsuit enforcement rights against a piece of property. They achieved in this lawsuit successfully litigating a successor liability claim. JJWM makes 3, I would submit, outrageous claims with regard to the bond, and none of them pass the red face test, and I don't think pass your inquiry here today. They claim they had no choice but to bond all claims and all parties. That they reasonably believed the bond only covered the conspiracy money judgment, and lastly, had the judgment provided differently, they could have excluded JJWM from the bond, which, of course, they could have done, not because the judgment might have been worded differently. They could have filed a bond that covered the 3, what they allege, are the 3 bond funders. They could have filed a bond that just covered the 4 individuals. They could have filed a bond that just covered the individuals and maybe PCSR, but they didn't. And the fact that they didn't is outcome determinative here, because by including JJWM, by including this cause of action, we were precluded from going and enforcing. And that's what a bond and stay does. And having got the advantage and benefits of going down that road, they can't hardly, as I used to hear people say, they can't hardly come before you and claim, that's not what we meant. That's not what the pleading said, and that's not what they did. And I would ask that you please direct this back to the trial court to satisfy the plaintiffs out of the bond that the defendants filed.
Don't go away. I have one more question. I want to take you over time. 13545-1016, it's a statute on garnishment, allows garnishment against a judgment debtor or a judgment debtor's property. And it says a judgment debtor is an entity that has a judgment entered against him in a court of competent jurisdiction. What judgment against JJWM are those garnishments in the water court issued pursuant to?
The judgment is the one that was issued by the jury and the judge in 2010, holding them liable for earlier obligations of PCSR. And I think, you know, one of the things that's important to consider about the garnishment issue is when we went back to Judge Barton on remand from PCSR1, we argued alternatively. These two issues weren't, they were obviously, there's some relatedness, but we argued 2 separate issues. We should win on this judge, but even if we don't, we're going to garnish the monies because it was submitted by all of these defendants, so it's their funds. So in terms of going back to the garnishment statute, the judgment here is a successor liability judgment, which newly created liability on the part of JJWM.
The judgment entered against JJWM in Park County doesn't contain a specific amount, however, does it?
Because the amount was always stipulated. There's never been any claim that the plaintiffs were seeking a dollar more or a dollar less.
And just so I'm clear, the amount of the bond was 125% of the judgment to cover interest and all that. The clerk of the court can't determine exactly how much is due today on the judgments.
Very readily. It's a simple mathematical calculation like any other interest calculation. The judge would probably be the one to make that determination, but it's it happens in every trial in every jurisdiction.
I'm taking you way over time. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Thank you again, Mr. Bain. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.